Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Window. This is our Group D World Cup preview podcast. We are joined by a number of special guests today who are going to preview Group D, which is shaping up to be an interesting one. It's a group that a number of people are looking at and thinking there might be some clear top two in this group and some clear bottom two. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think when you hear from this panel, they will feel a lot different about what is expected from this group. And so we're going to start, introduce everyone to our guests. And so, Maher, let's start with you.
Sure. So my name is Maher Mizahi. I'm actually an Algerian journalist, but I cover North African football for a lot of different media outlets in English, the likes of the BBC, sometimes The Guardian, ESPN, Al Jazeera. And you can mostly find me on Twitter at Mizahi Maher. So my last name, M-E-Z-A-H-I, and then my first name, Maher, M-A-H-E-R.
And Maher's going to be our resident Tunisia expert. Thank you for joining us. Sasha, let's go to you next.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Work for the A-League in Australia, so the obviously the official league here, so close to that. Worked for Stats Perform for 11 years before that. And yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Sashko, so it's S-A-C-H-K-0. And yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us. Murad, let's go to you next.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Murad Amawi. I am a sports and data analyst at the Danish club HBQ. I can be found on Twitter at Moa_Achilles and also on the account UEFA_points, where I do a lot of rambling about coefficient rankings and stuff like that for UEFA competitions.
And Jeremy.
Oh, you're on mute.
Sorry. Hi, I'm Jeremy. I'm French football correspondent, podcaster and writer for French Football Weekly, Get French Football News, and also have appeared on CNN, Guardian, Sky Sports, just a little bit of this and that kind of thing. And you can find me mainly on Twitter at JeremySmith98.
Awesome. We've really got a great group, and thank you all for joining us today. I want to start with you, Jeremy, and talk a little bit about France, because they're a team that are highly favored to progress, to go deep into this tournament. And you see some names that are not in the squad, N'Golo Kanté, Paul Pogba, but France is a team that is supremely talented. I think when you look at the roster top to bottom, you could certainly make an argument up there with Brazil that just talent-wise, top to bottom, France is among the most talented in the whole field. Do you think there are expectations that France is going to come back and repeat what happened in 2018? Or do you think that's a little bit too far ahead for the team to think with this group of teams in the group stage?
I think it's hard to say. As you said, on paper, France have got a very good squad. And I think the fact that, as you mentioned, a lot of players who could easily walk into a lot of other squads don't even make the final 25, as Deschamps chose to make it yesterday, shows the strength and depth that they've got. But at the same time, firstly, there's obviously the sort of jinx of the defending champions in recent tournaments. Secondly, there are issues with the France squad on and off the pitch. We might get into it later. I think some things about France imploding are slightly overdone, but there are issues there. And thirdly, to be honest, for me, you look at the forwards, and yeah, a lot of them are world-class. But keeper, defence, midfield, especially with the injuries they've got, I'm not actually sure how many of those players would walk into a World 11, for example. And so, you know, it might be my sort of naturally pessimistic side here, but although it is clearly one of the most competitive squads in the tournament, I'm not necessarily sure that makes them sort of favourites to defend their title. But obviously, you know, that they should certainly be expected to get into the knockout stages, at the very least, you know, maybe the final four, and anything less than that would be considered a bit of a disappointment.
So where on the field would you say is France's biggest weakness then, Jeremy?
For me, it's probably the midfield. As you said, Pogba and Conte are both injured. I believe that they never lost a match, that they started together. So that's a lot of experience there. Conte, I think everyone knows that he's the kind of player that you appreciate more when he's not there, because you realize that he's someone who just pops up everywhere and was one of the unsung heroes of the last World Cup, maybe sort of hidden a bit because he had a poor match in the final due to illness, but generally one of the stars. And Pogba, I think, is as important off the pitch as on it. And you just need to sort of YouTube his pre-match pep talks before the knockout stages of the last tournament to show how important he is. So I think that's really important. And the fact that the players there are either quite inexperienced or just not of the same quality. Tchouameni's done really well since he came into the France team, and for me would probably have been walked into the team ahead of maybe one of those two players in any case. But after Tchouameni, there's three or four players competing to play next to him, and none of them are really standing out. And then defensively as well, although a lot of the players appearing in the squad are the same defenders that were there 4 years ago, there's nowhere near as much the same stability. Everything last time was based on a very, very mean defence, and none of them are in the same kind of form or fitness. Varane and Hernandez are both injured. If Kimpembe starts, I know that I'm certainly not the only person who simply doesn't rate him, and I'm surprised when he gets into the PSG team, let alone the France team. And partly because of Deschamps experimenting with different formations and losing a lot of balance and maybe missing out on the amount of defensive work that Giroud and Griezmann did together, the defence is not in the same state as it was 4 years ago, and that could be an issue too.
What are your thoughts on Benzema? Sorry about that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's impressive that he won his first Ballon d'Or at the age of 34. I think it's probably a phenomenon that we're seeing across all major sports now. When you look at the likes of, Messi, Ronaldo, LeBron James, Tom Brady in the States, it seems like players are hitting their prime a little bit later in their careers. Whereas when I was growing up watching as a kid, footballers seem to peak at 27, 28. That's when we say they hit their prime physically and mentally. But I think things are changing now, and we're starting to see that with Benzema. So I think Benzema has always been very talented. He hasn't always been the most physically gifted, but very technically gifted. I think there was a period in his career where he was surrounded probably by the wrong people. I'm sure he's done a lot of things that were impulsive that he regrets as well. So it wasn't always the greatest chemistry piece, but I do think a lot of younger players looked up to him in that squad. So he does have a little bit of a big brother role within that national team. So, I mean, the best thing about a striker like Benzema is that he really brings out the best of your wide forwards. So Kylian Mbappe is the best player on the team. So having that kind of partnership, I think, and Griezmann as well, a striker like Benzema is probably the best kind of profile to bring out the qualities of Griezmann and Mbappe. So I think that front three is probably what's going to propel France to a late run if they can make it.
So there are a lot of great players on the France squad, obviously. You look at a squad like Tunisia. Do you have high expectations? Do you have moderate expectations? Do you have no expectations? What are you expecting to see from this Tunisia team and this group, and particularly against France?
Yeah, we go from one of the squads that has some of the most recognizable names in the World Cup in France to Tunisia, which is probably one of the sides that has some of the least recognizable names to your run-of-the-mill average football fan that, follows the Premier League. To kind of understand where Tunisia is coming from, I think you have to get a mindset for what the country is. We're talking about a country of 12 million people, no major natural resources, but on the African continent, they've always battled as heavyweights. Despite the low population, despite decrepit footballing infrastructure, no crazy footballing academies, and they still hold their own against the likes of Egypt, which has more than 100 million people, Nigeria, which has almost 200 million people, their neighbors, Algeria and Morocco, that have like the great football infrastructure and the academies and the massive diasporas in Europe. And I always wonder, like, where does that come from? And I've made a few trips to Tunisia and I've spoken to Tunisians. And I think that's exactly what it is. I think the fact that they know that they're not really fighting, it's not a fair fight, that forces them to sort of take on these intangibles. And that's what makes them really difficult to beat. So what are intangibles? So the main word, if you're going to associate one word to the Tunisian national team, is grinta, the Italian word, which means grit. And they, for them, it's also their motto. It's also their slogan. They like to say that they like their team, to watch their team play with grit. And when you watch the Tunisian national team, how they manage to sort of punch above their weight is that they're always a little bit stronger in the tackle. They'll always whine a little bit more to the referee. They'll always take a few more seconds longer when their goalkeeper's cramping. It's just the little things that they do because they want to win so badly and they're really, really good at it. So I know, like, it's not the, I mean, you speak to somebody that's going to break down the Tunisian national team, you want to know details. And I tell you about the intangibles, which are vague, but that's honestly what makes them a good team. But if you look at their squad of 26, it hasn't been announced yet. They do have a lot of experienced players. Their left wing and captain, Youssef Msakni, he has more than 85 caps. He's a player that could have probably played in the top five European league, maybe in the Champions League or in the Europa League. He has the technical quality to do so, but he chose the easy route. He chose to go to Qatar in 2013 when he was ready to take off and make good money. And that's actually a phenomenon that we've seen with a lot of North African players. If they're going to have to fight their way up and go through a small club in Portugal or Belgium or second division in France, a lot of them would actually prefer to go to Qatar or Saudi Arabia and just be comfortable and say, why do I have to try to prove myself in Europe? And it might work and it might not work and I'm not making great wages. So Msakni chose that route and he was a sort of trailblazer over there. Before the 2018 World Cup, he suffered an ACL injury and that sidelined him for 6 months. And so this is kind of like widely expected to be his first and last World Cup, and he's extremely motivated to do very well. So Tunisia and Morocco, but especially Tunisia, I think they do lack a true number nine. They've had Wahbi Khazri, who's many people know, former Sunderland, former Bastia, Saint-Etienne. He's sort of deputized as a false nine. It's been okay. He has good movement. He harries defenders. Doesn't really have the height or the physicality to challenge for balls in the air. But I think their main strength is that experience along the front line. So Naim Sliti, a lot of experience in League One as well, Wahbi Khazri and Youssef Msakni. And then especially the midfield. So in midfield, you have a midfield trio of Elias Khiri, who used to play for Montpellier, and now who's been playing very, very good football at FC Cologne in Germany. He sometimes is the captain over there. He's pretty much their best or second best player. He, in 2020, 2021, in the Bundesliga, he had actually covered the most distance out of any of the players. So that kind of tells you what he's going to do with Tunisia. He'll cover fullbacks. He's really good in the tackle, good at interceptions, level-headed, very professional. He could be Tunisia's best player. He's in his prime. He'll be sitting in a holding role. In front of him, you have, I think, one of the more underrated players in this World Cup, Issa Lidouni. He's playing for Ferencváros in Hungary. He's probably one of the best players in the Hungarian league and is expected to make a big move to a top five European league post World Cup. So he'll play in front of Skhiri, and his job is to really break play up and be combative and fight against other midfields. And then the third option is one of the most interesting ones. So you have Mohamed Ali bin Ramadan, who's one of the best talents in Africa, currently playing on the continent. He plays for Esperance Tunis. Or you have the Manchester United wonder kid, Hannibal Mejbri, who is actually on loan to Birmingham City this year, and he's been having a great year on loan with Birmingham City. So I think their midfield is their strong point. Their front line has a lot of experience, but they're not really great in the two final thirds of the pitch, defending in their box and attacking in the opponent's box. They don't score a lot of goals. They also don't concede a lot of goals, but when they concede silly goals. So yeah. Tunisia, sorry, that was very long-winded, but Tunisia for me, a limited squad, but a squad that has the intangibles to maybe make it out of the group.
Yeah, I think they're going to be tough for any team to get by. And prior to them just losing to Brazil 5-1, they had gone seven straight matches not allowing a goal.
Sorry to cut you off, but just a quick statistic to buttress what you've just said. prior to the Brazil match, they'd conceded, I believe, 26 goals in the last 51 matches going back to 2019. So they're a difficult team to score against. But then they got thrashed by Brazil. But sorry, you were saying?
Yeah. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how they do up against a France or a Denmark that is more along the lines of a top 5-10 team in the world than perhaps some of the opposition that Tunisia's seen throughout Africa and against some of the other teams they've played more recently.
I mean, that is the big question. Tunisia have never gotten out of a group stage in the World Cup. This is going to be their sixth participation. They've always fallen short. They've always failed in the group stages. Many people don't believe this is the best Tunisian side that's been to a World Cup. Again, they do have some decent players. They are difficult to break down. But the only thing that I would say gives them a little bit of a better chance this time around is that there's a big diaspora of Tunisians in Qatar. There's 30,000 Tunisians that are living in Qatar, and I can almost guarantee that most of them will be at the stadiums. And so they will have this kind of home support away from home, which I think can make a difference. I think that's one of the things that we often overlook when we talk about African or Asian teams at World Cups. The best result an Asian team ever had at a World Cup was when the World Cup was hosted in Asia in 2002, and same thing in Africa when Ghana was one kick away from making it to a semifinal. So I think that kind of home support could maybe bring a little bit of an edge to this Tunisian national team. But overall, I mean, when you look at the squads on paper, France and Denmark are just a step above.
And speaking of being in Qatar and not being the Qatar national team, I wanted to talk to Sasha about Australia because it feels like they've been playing in Qatar for a very long time now and are familiar with the surroundings and have gone through qualification and are familiar with Qatar. What do you think the support from the Australians is going to be like in Qatar?
There'll be a solid group traveling. There was a decent contingent during the playoffs against UAE and Peru. But just this World Cup is really interesting in terms of, for the Socceroos anyway, this is not our golden generation. And I'm sure not many people expecting us to probably get out of the group or win the World Cup, even though we'd like to. But I think this is about the storylines with this squad in particular, just the feel-good stories. You know, I'm sure if you would have heard of Grand Quoll that's going to Newcastle, but he's an 18-year-old kid that hasn't started a professional game of football yet, played, you know, an all-star game against Barcelona, come off the bench in the A-League here, going to Newcastle, you know, a Sudanese refugee that moves here with his family. Only a year or so ago, he was playing, you know, state league football, not professional football. Got picked up and now he's off to a World Cup. Jason Cummings, a former Rangers forward, played at Hibs, moved to Australia 10 months ago, and now he's going to the World Cup. Stuff like that I think are probably the standout things aside from the football. I'm not expecting a lot of, you know, us to do damage. Our coach, Graham Arnold, probably, I was talking he was going to be sacked before the playoffs. He obviously got through that, and I'll probably give him a statue. But, you know, it's a different – I was at the World Cup in Russia, and we had Bert van Marwijk come in to, you know, last minute to oversee that. Before him was Ange Postecoglou. If you're not aware of Ange being at Celtic, but his football is very proactive and exciting. Graham Arnold's complete opposite of that. Not many people sort of a fan the way he sort of plays. I'm not personally a fan. I don't like the way he plays, but he got us to a World Cup and you can't take that away from him. So to see, you know, these sort of storylines are what excites me. Probably the biggest talking point and is Matt Ryan and the goalkeeping situation, him not playing at FC Copenhagen. It's, if you look at the three goalkeepers in the squad, they're hardly playing. You got a goalkeeper, Mitch Langerak, in Japan that was named his club MVP, broke his the league's clean sheet record twice. And if you look at the stat, he actually has more clean sheets than Matt Ryan has appearances in the last couple of years. So that's probably been the biggest thing. There's been a lot of positives with the squad, but that's been the big thing down here. The reaction to that is not having Mitch in the squad. But yeah, I'm not expecting the World Cup, anything can happen. There's, you know, you get surprises. But yeah, I'm not expecting a great deal from the Socceroos. They could surprise, but I think we'll just enjoy the ride as Aussies down here and see what happens. Maybe we can surprise the French. You know, we're familiar with, you know, with Denmark and France from the previous World Cup. And it's really sort of annoying when we say talk about Aussies and, you know, that never say die attitude, you know, we punch up out of our weight, but that'll be a familiar thing this month, but we'll see what happens.
You look at the squad and there are 10 of the 26 players that have five or fewer appearances for the national team. So you mentioned it's not really the golden generation, but clearly there's an intent to move towards some of this younger, newer talent. That, of course, some of the goalkeepers are not necessarily that young, but just not as experienced with the national team. Are you expecting to see some of these players, a lot of these players, are really more of a shift back to some of the more experienced guys in the squad?
I definitely think we'll see some of the newer faces. You look at someone like Cam Devlin, and if you haven't seen on the Socceroos Twitter page, but they shared the footage of him receiving the call from Graham Arnold, and that was just great. He just started crying on the phone. But he's doing great things at Hearts in Scotland, and that's Scotland's become a place for Aussies at the moment after Ange to play their football. So I expect to see someone like him who's 24, a real sort of hard-nosed midfielder. So I expect to see him play. There'll be some new faces. I think the biggest concern for me with the Socceroos is their defence, actually, just to sort of change tack a bit. But if you look at the centre-back area, you've got three there that have hardly played. Harry Suter that's playing at Stoke City, just come back from an ACL injury, was out for a year. He actually just made his first start a couple of days ago at, you know, first team full. He played a couple of under 23 games. And then you have Kai Rowles is playing at Hearts as well in Scotland. He was out for a long time. You've got Milos Deganek that's playing at Columbus Crew, but their season finished over a month ago. So that's your three sort of main centre backs that hardly had any football. So that's a big concern going into a, you know, a World Cup, and you've got France in the first game against, you know, Mbappe and Benzema. So that's a really big issue, and how he deals with that will be very interesting.
I want to ask Murat a little bit about Denmark as well. And I think in talking to Mara and Sasha, and I've steered the conversation that way a little bit, is how do we match up against Denmark? Or sorry, how do we match up against France? And really, what do you expect there? And I think Denmark is a team that certainly on our podcast, we have been admirers of, think they're a really good squad. They just finished ahead of France in the UEFA Nations League. What are your expectations for Denmark? And is the mindset more along the lines of perhaps of France, where you're thinking not just are we going to get out of this group stage, but how deep in this tournament are we going to go? Or do you think there is a little bit more focus on the group stage and just making sure that the team gets the job done to start with?
I think one of the things that have been a key thing about Kasper Juhlmann, our national coach, is how much into detail he goes into analyzing every single opponent to the degree where they can use like AI technology to analyze certain parts of the opponents, and then look at are we going to look at blocking the opponent's strengths, or are we going to look at hitting the opponents where they are at the weakest and finding that right balance? I think that has been a key for Kasper Juhlmann throughout his tenure as national coach. And one of the things that he has been excellent in implementing is the tactical versatility within the squad. And if you look at some of the matches that were played in during the World Cup qualifiers, the first three matches in March against Israel away, against Moldova at home, and against Austria away. One of the things was Denmark scored pretty early in those matches. And well, because there are five substitutions in these matches, it was very important for him and for the rest of the team is to practice that tactical versatility throughout those matches. So you would see, okay, are we playing with three in the back, or are we playing with four in the back? There were different variations throughout the matches, and that is something that he actively uses in the matches in general. So I think he's not going to underestimate any of the opponents in that regard. And well, when the majority of the team was presented on Monday, one of the things that he said to the Danish fans that were there were like, "See you on December 19th with the trophy."
So it does sound like Denmark is certainly has aspirations of progressing deep into the tournament.
Yeah, but then again, we are realistic, because we also know that the way that the draw panned out means that if we're unlucky, then and we progress from the group stage, we might be unlucky and run into Argentina in the round of 16. And if we do that, then we're kind of screwed. because Messi wants that World Cup trophy, and I have a lot of difficulty seeing which team is going to stop them. Maybe Brazil, but yeah, if both Brazil and Argentina win their group, they're going to run into each other in the semifinal. So
absolutely. I wanted to circle back with Sasha a little bit, and just thinking about Australia, and if they are thinking about a path through, and it's not just about the storylines, but let's get out of this group. Do you think it's an easier path through Denmark, or do you think it's an easier path through France? Because ultimately, one of those teams would have to not make it in order for Australia to get through.
Oh, well, yeah. Which one? I'm obviously France on paper, the team to beat, but I have a lot of respect and serious concerns about the Danish, the football they've been playing in their form. The thing we've seen with the French in the past is, especially recently, they can implode. I doubt they will, but, the first game, you just never know what might happen. We've seen, first games in the past with the French against Senegal. We don't know. The biggest threat to me will be Denmark. If we manage to get a point off the French, I definitely take that. That's a tough question to pick between those two. They're both so strong. And when you look at the Socceroos squad, they're going to be setting up very defensively the way Arnold likes to play. Sort of sit back and hopefully just strike on the counter. But that first game, if we manage to get a point out of that, or just something out of that to build on, and anything's possible, really. I wouldn't hold my breath, to be honest.
Fair enough.
I think you also might want to consider that some of the Australian players actually know some of the Danish players. Like you said, Matty Ryan has been playing for FC Copenhagen for the first few months while Camille Grabar was injured. And you also have players like Joel King, who plays in OB Odense Boldklub. And Awema Bill has a long history in FC Midtjylland. So I think their knowledge about Denmark is something that we have to take seriously as a country. Basically, we have those three Aussie spies that we have to be aware of. Maybe that's why Matty Ryan hasn't been playing that much.
And we do have Thomas Sorensen living in Melbourne at the moment, so we can just tap him on the shoulder and ask for any inside information.
Yeah, yeah. He's painting something at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I think Sasha's right about France as well, though. I mean, they're slow starters in tournaments, and you only need to look to the last World Cup. And, Australia weren't that far away from getting a draw then, and arguably it was a relatively soft penalty that France got during that match. So France obviously start as favourites, but I don't think it would be the biggest shock in the world if Australia were to grab a point there.
And it's really interesting. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, sorry. I wanted to follow up with Jeremy a little bit on France. But before I do that, I did want to mention, for Denmark, it's been interesting to see their Nations League campaign, because, they've They've got the double over France in their group, but they also dropped a double against Croatia. And I don't have an answer to this question. Maybe one of you do, but what is it about Croatia that Denmark has struggled to overcome, but hasn't had that same issue with like France? And obviously they're two different teams. I'm sure they play
the midfield. The Croatian midfield is, out of this world. When you have a player like Luka Modric in the squad, then anything can happen. And the first match that was played in Parken in Copenhagen, Modric didn't start the game, and Denmark was dominant during that part of the game. And then when he came in, things changed. But I think with Croatia, it's been quite a very even matchup, even though Denmark has lost two times in within 90 minutes and then again on penalties at the World Cup in 2018. But it's been very even games, and it's come down to basically a few like coincidences. Lack of concentration on a set piece or something like that. So then
going to on your point, going back to what Jeremy said earlier, as he kind of identified the midfield for France maybe being a weak point, it's very difficult for, I think, for any team to get a double over a team in a year's time, I guess. And so we could potentially be seeing Denmark maybe beating France three times, and that would be remarkable just in and of itself. But for Jeremy, my question was, you mentioned earlier maybe there's some strife in the camp. And for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with that, can you just briefly summarize maybe what's going on there?
Yeah, before I do that, I just want to crowbar in case I don't get another chance to. If anyone's looking for omens, every time that France or Denmark have won a major tournament, they've been in the same group.
Interesting.
Denmark were also in France's group in 2002, so it hasn't always gone well for France.
Yeah, exactly. But every time France hasn't lost to Denmark, they have won the group, the tournament in general. In 1984... In 1998,
2018. Although 1998, 2000, because it was the last match, it didn't matter so much, I think.
And also in the Euro in 2000, when Thierry Henry ran right past Søren Kolding and he was trailing after like 5 miles away.
But in answer to your question, I mean, I think there's often talk about infighting within the squad. I wouldn't say that there's been any of that so far. I think it's just a general feeling, you know, with a lot of injuries, a lot of lack of form. Pogba's kind of taken a lot of attention, firstly because of his injury and will he come back in time, but then also what's been happening with him off the pitch, the issue with his brother and blackmailing. There's also been issues with the French Football Federation, which in theory doesn't affect the players, but that it does seem to be a correlation between when everything is going well off the pitch and the federation and the squad are in harmony and they're picking the right kind of hotels to stay in, that kind of thing. The team does well. If they take their eye off the ball in some way, then it doesn't so much. So although it shouldn't affect the players on the pitch, it actually could do. Mbappe, he's losing his shine a little bit as the golden boy of French football, because he's sometimes acting like a sort of petulant spoilt brat. And, you know, first of all, there's the issue with the sort of player sponsorship and image rights, which hasn't gone down well with the federation, although arguably has maybe federated the players a little more. But it's more, for me, it's more the fact that, in the build up to Euro 2020 or 21, one of the issues was that there was a sort of little bit of tension between him and Giroud. Yet recently he's been singing Giroud's praises basically as a sort of pawn in his games to play the position that he wants to play in for PSG. And I think that he's doing a little bit too much of this and looking after himself and playing people off against each other. So it's not that players themselves are feuding, but I just think some of that, all of this leads to not a bad atmosphere, but certainly not as serene as things were in 2018. I think also to be honest, in 2018, I'm not sure many French people thought France were going to win it. I think for me, certainly, I thought probably semi-finals, but I saw Germany, Spain, Brazil as better. And so I feel like this time there's a lot more pressure on them that they didn't have 4 years ago.
Yeah, certainly. And we alluded to it a little bit, and I think Sasha had mentioned, but three of these teams were in the same exact group at the 2018 World Cup. Denmark, France, Australia were in the same group. And the fourth team was Peru in that instance. This time it is Tunisia. And it sounds like, especially France and Denmark were just in the same Nations League group. There's tends to be a lot of familiarity between France, Denmark, Australia even. I want to hear from Mar about Tunisia, and there's probably not as much. And do you think some of that uncertainty or unknown about Tunisia could help them be a little bit of a surprise?
Yeah, I don't know how much. I mean, now with Y Scout and Instat and, you know, each of these fed, you guys have artificial intelligence over there. I mean, like, it's very difficult to be an unknown. It's not like the 1960s and 70s and 80s. But for example, even in France, I mean, they'll know a lot of Tunisian players. They'll know, like, the players that Jeremy will know, Dylan Brun, who played at Metz for a few years. They'll know, like, even he'll know for Jenny Sessi, who played at Metz for what, like, a few weeks, maybe. I don't even remember too much. But like, a lot of these players have played in the French league, so they're not, like, very unknown to the French public or to maybe even French players. Whereas Denmark may be a little more unfamiliar with them. So I think Tunisia, it's kind of like a thing of the past, kind of where you say, oh, we're going to be the surprise package. They don't know who our players are. I think scouting is so advanced these days that doesn't really make that much of a big difference. I do think, like I said, the supporters being there, I think that's going to make a little bit of a difference. It's going to motivate them. But besides that, it just doesn't feel like I'm conflicted because it just doesn't feel like Tunisia's year, to be honest. It doesn't. The coach is an interim manager. He's one of two managers in this World Cup that have never played senior football in the first division, the other being Canada's John Herdman. He was just supposed to be an interim manager at the beginning of the year, and then they let him have the job for the final round of World Cup qualifying. He manages to squeak past Mali because it was 0-0 or 1-0-0-0 in the double-headed playoff, and it was an own goal. They didn't even score their own goal, their proper goal. And then he just sort of stumbled into this role and they said, okay, well, here's the keys, go to the World Cup. So the coaching is not great. The players feel like the main crux of this team is just 1 or 2 years past their prime. It doesn't really, they're kind of unbalanced. Like I said, they can hold on to possession. They're difficult to break down, but they don't score a lot of great goals and they concede some stupid goals. So it doesn't feel like they're going to be able to make it out of the group despite the home away from home advantage. It just feels like one of those sides where that you could stub your toe against. So you got to be careful. You got to be on your P's and Q's because they can trip you up and frustrate you and bore you to a 0-0 or 1-1. But I don't think they're going to make it out of the group.
What do you think their path would have to be to get out of the group?
Have to beat Australia and then frustrate Denmark and France. I don't think they're hoping for victories against those two. You're going to see probably a very negative, very defensive Tunisian side against those two.
All right. Want to ask about predictions for this group and ultimately what you think is going to happen and where does that leave each team? Because I think Murad brought up a great point earlier in that with this group, you do have that looming Argentina team that is predicted by most people to top their group in Group C, and therefore a second place finish in this group could very well set up a team against Argentina in the round of 16, which is very dangerous. Murad, I want to ask you, what are you expecting to see from Denmark? Do you think they have enough to top the group, or do you think they will finish second or even perhaps miss out?
I think if Denmark wants to top the group, we have to beat France because I believe that even if we win against both Australia and Tunisia, I have a feeling that if France pulls itself together and doesn't implode, they're going to win those two matches as well. And I think that with a striker trio like Mbappe, Giroud, and Griezmann, they're going to score more goals than Denmark because we don't have that world-class performing striker at the moment. We have a lot of very decent strikers who have been selected, but none of them are playing at the very, very, very top in the world. We have players like Andreas Cornelius, who scored two goals against France in June, and then we have Jonas Wind, who was injured during a big part of September, plays in Wolfsburg in the Bundesliga. Who else do we have? We have Kasper Dolberg, who has not had a good spell in Sevilla this past 6 months or fewer months than that. So the goals are going to have to come from elsewhere. And also one of the things that I fear a little bit about that game against Tunisia, apart from being the first game and everyone is a bit nervous and everything, like you brought up, there's going to be a huge Tunisian crowd there. And I also believe that the local crowd is also going to support Tunisia in their game because cultural similarities.
Yeah.
And I also worry a little bit that the crowd is going to be a bit hostile towards Denmark because Denmark has been so outspoken about human rights violations and gay rights, transgender rights for people, human rights in general. And we've seen campaigns from Qatar being not that pleasant towards Denmark. So Denmark should be prepared that the crowd might be a bit hostile towards them.
Plus, I actually think that's an important... Yeah, sorry, go on.
And there's only going to be like maybe 800 Danish supporters in Qatar, maximum. We've seen in other tournaments, there have been more Danish supporters than Saruman sent legions of Uruk-hai towards Helm's Deep in Lord of the Rings. But yeah.
No, but that is a really important dynamic that he brought up. I didn't actually think of that, but the hostility from the home crowd and coupled with the Tunisian home support, I think could be a tricky factor for the Danish national team. And I just wanted to, here's a question to the panel. How much stock do we put in actually having been to Qatar and playing in those stadiums? Because there was the FIFA Arab Cup in 2021 where Tunisia went, 60-70% of the squad went to Qatar and played in those stadiums. It's like the former Confederation Cup. Does that matter? I don't know if that kind of familiarity helps or not, but some Tunisians like to point to that as perhaps a slight advantage if it adds, I don't know, 1-2% extra, but I don't know. I really don't.
I wrote it down as an extra advantage for Tunisia in my predictions, but it's something that has to be put into consideration as well.
I think that's a great question for Sasha, because that's Australia. We brought up before, had played the playoff there, and with COVID, a number of matches were relocated as well. What do you expect or think about Mara's question? And does Australia gain any advantage from just having familiarity with Qatar and the conditions there?
Yeah, I just think experience of the region and the way, you know, we've played a lot of it, played in some tough conditions, you know, the Middle East, and I think very tough playing over there in the past. These stadiums, obviously, the benefit of being air conditioned, but we have sort of tended to struggle previously in those warm climates. But I think it will sort of hold them in good stead, just having those June playoffs, and just playing there previously. And also just on the, you know, the hostility, I think the Socceroos could come in for a bit of that as well with the video they released. I think it was last week or the week before. The Qataris got back to that, some officials, and sort of weren't too happy with what was said and what was put out by the players. So there might be something in that as well for the Aussies. But yeah, I think playing there previously and just being ready for the warm conditions, even though it's not summer, I think it'll help them out a little bit, but
I think so too. And I think with the tournament so close to when leagues are stopping, I think it minimizes the amount of time that players are going to have to get adjusted. And we've talked a little bit about that from more of an injury standpoint of it's close and some players that picked up a knock here or there may not be going, whereas if they had a June World Cup, they might have a bit more time to recover and actually be able to be there. But there's not a lot of time to get adjusted to time difference, to weather difference. It is, to Sasha's point, I was looking at some of the weather today. It is still very, very hot there. And it is going to cool down as the tournament goes on. But I don't really think in the group stage it's going to cool off all that much. And getting acclimated to that environment can be difficult. Jeremy, I wanted to ask you, because the French team is pretty much all still playing in their domestic leagues top to bottom today. When is the team going? Do you know that? And do you expect that environment and climate to impact them in a negative way?
Yeah, they're going, I think they're meeting up maybe on Monday in Clairefontaine. I'm not 100% sure when they're going to Qatar, but it's definitely an issue. As fans as well, it's frustrating that there's no sort of end of season and then build up to the World Cup. But for players, even more so, as you said, because of injuries, but because there's no friendlies beforehand, very little time to acclimatise. And I think it could affect France more. I mean, in previous tournaments, they've arranged, obviously, friendlies just before the World Cup, but also maybe the previous summer they'd have played in that country, or I think even Russia they set up a couple of friendlies or matches in that region beforehand. Here it's I think it is going to be very new to a lot of those players, and you know, more or less stepping off the plane and straight onto the football pitch. It could be a factor when they need to kind of hit form straight away. Yeah, as I said, you know, Australia is not straightforward. Denmark, probably ideally, France would have liked that to have been the third match where they would have hoped to have already got enough points to then be able to rest a few players. It's not straightforward at all.
So we have talked about a lot of the conditions and missing players in midfield and time to get acclimated. A lot of concerns and what ifs. Ultimately, France should still either finish second or first in this group. What are your expectations in this group? Do you think there's a surprise in store here, or are you expecting it to be fairly straightforward?
If France don't qualify, it will be a massive disappointment, big shock, big crisis. They should qualify, but I certainly don't think it's going to be straightforward. Again, I keep alluding to 4 years ago. It was very much not straightforward then either. Scraped past Australia, weren't fantastic against Peru, and then the Denmark match didn't matter so much. I think, however they do it, I think they really need to get 3 points in the first match, because then there's a little bit less pressure against Denmark. They could probably both get away with a draw if they've both won their first match. It just gives them a little bit more sort of leeway to, as we said, acclimatize. But I think that first match is a big banana skin because of everything that we said. So I'm concerned it's not going to be straightforward in any way. I don't think France will get 3 wins, but I have to say that they should get through, because it would sound ridiculous to say that they won't. But I've just got this niggly feeling.
And so I think a number of people would not be surprised to see this one come down to goal difference, with as well as Denmark have been playing, as well as France have been playing. Murad said he was a little bit concerned about goal difference, but Murad, I wanted to ask you, would you be surprised to hear that over their last 25 games, France has scored 52 goals and Denmark has scored 57 goals?
Well, we did play against Moldova 2 times, and we scored a load of goals against them. So
I may have
we have to take that into account. We did play against some, well, not that strong opponents during the World Cup qualification. So we have to put that into consideration. But yeah, I think, and also one of the things that's been very, very interesting about Denmark also is that it's a lot of different goal scorers. You see players from the midfield, you've seen strikers, you've seen the wingers, second strikers, even some of the defenders have been scoring a lot of these goals. So it's spread out very nicely, evenly. So I think that's going to be a bit of a hassle for all the teams to be aware of, okay, who's going to score the goals. Like, for instance, on set pieces, not only do we have usually have a big striker that we can aim for, but we also have players like Thomas Delaney from Sevilla, and you also have players like Joachim Andersen, Simon Kjær, Andreas Christensen that you can aim for. So there are a lot of players that can be dangerous on set pieces as well.
And I just wanted to ask a little bit about Christian Eriksen and really what it means for him to be there. Of course, with everything that happened at Euro, I think.
I was actually there at the stadium when it happened. Actually, wow. I was working at the stadium, so I was standing at that end with all the Finnish fans. And first of all, big kudos for the Finnish fans, the way they behaved in that situation. And it's going to be very emotional when Denmark is going to meet Finland in the Euro qualifiers next year. But big thanks to the Finnish fans. They were amazing. But yeah, it's going to be a big thing to have Christian Eriksen back. I think when you look at how Denmark played without their MVP, we've tried that on two different occasions this past year and a half, because, well, during the fall of, well, first of all, during the Euros and also during the fall of 2021, Christian Eriksen was out, and we didn't know if he's going to come back, if he's going to play football again, or we don't know that. We didn't know at the time. And in December last year, our captain, Simon Kjær, got an ACL injury. So he was out also. So suddenly, what are we going to do? So suddenly, the plan for 2022 was a bit up in the air. What's going to happen? And to be honest, the way that Christian Eriksen plays means that Denmark is able to be more in possession when he's on the pitch. And I think if he had been on the pitch, I'm confident we would have beaten England in that semifinal. At least we would have gone to a penalty shootout. They wouldn't have gotten that outrageous penalty that we're still pissed off about, most of us anyway.
I think that speaks to the quality of Denmark and how far they truly can go in this tournament. They were in the semifinals. They were without Christian Eriksen. And I think to see them go deep into this tournament would not be surprising.
And also the thing that, I mean, Christian Eriksen could have said, okay, you know what? I am close to 30. I have won an Italian championship. I've played in a Champions League final. I've played over 100 matches for the national team. I can call it quits.
That's what I would have done.
Yeah, but what we see within this team, and this is also one of the things that we really need to highlight, is how much they care about each other as a team. Like, it's a very close-knit friendship between all of them. And also there's this love of playing for your country that is, in some cases, it's a bit rare to see. Like, for instance, I don't see it the same way for instance, the French team. It's more like individuals playing more for themselves than what you would see with Denmark, that is more tightly fit unit.
Yeah.
I think that's a major thing. And Christian Eriksen is there because he wants to, basically. He's back on the national team because he feels this is important to me. This is something that I do with great pleasure. And if you look at the way he's been playing this past year, it's like it's playing with like a big weight has been taken off his shoulders. It feels like he's playing with a lighter, well, basically, like he's more free in the way that he plays. He plays with more versatility. And we also see that he's been used in a different role in Manchester United. Instead of playing like that 10 position or like a bit of a winger position, we suddenly see him on the central midfield playing well, basically playing a central midfielder as well. And I think that also adds to the possibilities, the tactical possibilities for Denmark as well, because suddenly we can change it, everything. If we want to play 3-4-3, then we can have him as a central midfielder next to Pierre-Emile Højbjerg. Or we can still play 4-2-3-1, and then we have a secondary striker in Jonas Wind, for instance, and then have a player like Andreas Cornelius up front. So suddenly there are more possibilities and also to find those spaces. It gives more possibilities to play with more tactical versatility.
I wanted to ask Sasha two questions. One, do you think, similar to what Murad was saying about how the Denmark team has really come together and playing for each other, do you think the way that Australia qualified for the World Cup has helped them gel in a similar manner? And then ultimately, what are you expecting out of this group? Do you think Australia can or will get out, or do you think it'll be fairly as expected with France and Denmark topping it?
I think with Aussies and Socceroos teams, you know, in previous years, they're always sort of a tight-knit group. They always come together, always, you know, digging deep and, you know, punching above their weight. That's never sort of been an issue, and I expect the same this tournament, and especially after what we saw in, you know, in Qatar with the playoffs. In terms of what I expect, I'd be surprised if we finish in the top two. But as I've said previously, anything's possible in football. So if we manage to sneak in, I'll take that. But I'd be happy if we finished, you know, third and didn't finish bottom of the group. But it all just depends on that first game and if we can get any momentum out of that to take into the, you know, the remaining two fixtures. But yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath on making it out. But no one expected us, and I didn't expect us to get past Peru, or even against the UAE, to be honest, that first playoff. And we exceeded that after really sort of pour into our qualifying in the AFC. So anything's possible. If we get a point against France and get a win in the second game or whatever, and it goes down to the last game, and sneak into the top two, I think there might be a national holiday in Australia if we manage to make it through after 2006, especially given that the team we have is anywhere near that golden generation. So I'm just looking forward to personally, just to see, you know, Grand Quol in this World Cup, and him coming off the bench against France is a real. You don't like to hype up young players too much or put, you know, pressure on them, but he really is an X factor that we haven't sort of seen with the, you know, the national team for a while. So I do expect him to come off the bench against France and do something. So that'll be one we're keeping an eye on, and hopefully we manage to get a point or maybe even beat the French.
It'll be great to see them. Even if it's more so getting experience, because there are a lot of young players coming into the team, and it has a bit of a different feel where you look at maybe some of the other teams that they aren't necessarily as willing to give some of those younger guys a chance. So at a minimum, I think even if Australia does not get out of the group, hopefully it's a good springboard for what they could achieve in the future. Mara, I wanted to ask you as well about what your expectations are for this group. Do you think it's France and Denmark, and do you think Tunisia has a chance to get out of this group at all?
Yeah, like I've already said, if I'm listening to my head, it's got to be France and Denmark. I think Australia and Tunisia are going to duke it out for the third place in this group. The one thing that I've actually sort of learned on this podcast, or at least it sort of popped into my mind, is when Murad was describing hostility and it feeling like a home atmosphere. I think that even for France, because you're going to have, it's not just Tunisians with the big diaspora, there's also Algerians and Moroccans. And when Tunisia or Morocco or Algeria have played against France in friendlies before, it's been booing of the French national anthem, and it's always a big controversy. So I started realizing we could probably see that in Qatar happen again, and maybe France is going to feel like they're playing three home or three away matches in the group stages. But besides the crowd dynamic, if we're strictly talking about 90 minutes on the pitch in a vacuum, I just don't see how Tunisia gets out of this group.
Joe, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I tend to agree with everybody. I think France and Denmark will be the ones that move out. And I'm gonna say Denmark tops the group with France going through in second. But there is one name I did want to shout out for Denmark, a player that I've kind of had my eye on for the last year that I really like, and I'm hoping he gets an opportunity to shine. And that would be Jesper Lindstrom. He's at Eintracht Frankfurt, and he is playing pretty well there, and moved there from Brøndby, or Brøndby, I guess is how you say it in Danish. I'm not 100% sure, but there you go. So he excites me a lot. But I think Denmark and France, I just think there's too much quality in both of those teams, and that's nothing against Tunisia or Australia. And if one of them manages to, you know, to kind of sneak out of the group, I think that's great. You know, what a storyline. That's fantastic. So, yeah, that's kind of my thoughts.
I think finishing first in this group is extremely important, especially with Argentina looming, especially when you look at the bracket and you think Brazil could be on the same side. There's a clear side of the bracket when you're looking at the knockout stages that teams favor. And I think it will make for a really interesting dynamic, because there might be instances, and it has occurred in the past, where teams are okay finishing second, and it'll put them on a more favorable side of the bracket. I don't think this is one of those cases. And I think more so than probably any other group in the whole World Cup, that first versus second is really going to be important. And so
it's going to be even more tricky. Sorry to interrupt you. It's going to be even more tricky because Group D is going to finish their third matches before Group C. So Argentina will basically, at that time, they will know if they go first, they will meet either France or Denmark or whoever it may be that tops the group. And so basically they can plan more ahead of like, who do we want to avoid? Because I'm pretty sure that they don't want to face France. They don't really want to face Denmark. So if they can avoid either one of them.
You can't see them intentionally.
Not intentionally, but I wouldn't be surprised if they give
rotate the squad.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's more likely that they will do so if they know, okay, well, it's okay if we draw this last match, because then we might avoid the French.
That will be an interesting dynamic to see with Group C playing afterwards. I'm torn. This is one I keep going back and forth on. I think Denmark's results against France have been there, and I think they know how to beat the French team. And I think you can't necessarily say the same about France with Denmark at this point in time. So I'm going to say that Denmark tops the group. I'm also going to go with Joe and say France finishes second. I am really looking forward to seeing the other two teams in Australia and Tunisia and seeing what they bring to the table. Australia especially, you know that there's going to be a lot of excitement in that team. And I'm really hoping that even if they don't make it out of the group, they stay really competitive throughout most of their matches and make them exciting. Australia is a team that when you watch them play their matches, and Maher, no disrespect or anything to Tunisia, but I find Australia matches more enjoyable to watch than Tunisia matches. And
they also, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, just big tournaments and World Cups. It seems like they always play up to the competition they play. They seem to do well in tournaments, whereas Tunisia, it's usually been the opposite. They seem to play down to.
Absolutely. So,
and I'm glad you're enjoying them play, because I haven't been enjoying them play recently. So I'm glad someone is.
Well, I have a question for Jeremy. Sorry to interrupt. I have a question for Jeremy. There have been some rumors about Zinedine Zidane taking over the French team after the World Cup, pretty much regardless of the result. Do you think that can affect the authority of Didier Deschamps during this World Cup?
I don't think so. I mean, arguably what affects his authority more than anything else is that he's very, very close to and tied to the president of the federation, who's under a lot of pressure. But I just think Deschamps has been there for so long now, and he clearly enjoys the job, but I feel like whatever happens, I'd be very surprised if he chooses to continue past this tournament. You know, if he wins it, it's a great, you know, great to leave on a high. If it goes very wrong after the Euros, he was pretty much told, you know, you've earned one sort of free pass, but no more. And I guess if it's somewhere middling, I just can't see him going past this stage anyway. And then the next thing is, I'm not convinced that Zidane is going to be a success as coach. I know he's done a great job at Real Madrid, and arguably the last title was more impressive because it wasn't with the great team that he kind of inherited. But I think international football is very different, and I'm not 100% sure he's got that sort of tactical nous, but we'll see.
It would be, just to piggyback off that, it'd be very interesting, and Maher may be able to speak to this, but it'd be interesting to maybe see him, Deschamps, obviously, maybe take over a French-speaking African country. I don't know if he'd be interested in that at all, but that would be interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of times this comes down to cold, hard cash, and the right. highest paid coaches in Africa usually earn between $60,000 and $80,000 per month, and I'm pretty sure Didier Deschamps is on at least triple that, if not more. So I'm not sure a lot of African countries could afford him, to be quite honest. And at the same time, this is going to be the first World Cup where you have five African coaches for five African national teams. There's a little bit of a new trend on this continent where we're sort of not really getting the latest coach from the European coaching carousel that's come down at the age of 65, 70 years old that, you know, wants to give one last hurrah to his career. Instead, they're more promoting former internationals, people like Senegal's Aliou Cissé, in Algeria, Jamel Belmadi, from Morocco, Walid Regragui. Mali's just hired Eric Schelle. South Africa, I'm sure, is going to give Benedict McCarthy a try pretty soon. So they're preferring to give these former internationals that don't have huge salary expectations young enough to relate to this younger generation of players. And it's been doing pretty well. So that's the new blueprint in Africa that I think a lot of federations are chasing. So I don't think Deschamps is an ideal candidate.
Yeah. No, that's fair. And just on Senegal, I did notice today, I think I saw an announcement that they extended Cissé's contract today, I think. So that's nice.
Yeah, he's been given sort of a free reign. He's been there since 2015, and I think he's only lost 7 or 8 matches since then, which is ridiculous. Obviously won the most recent AFCON and has experience at a World Cup, so this could be an occasion for him to really... But that might just be more of a salary, sort of sign a new contract to raise a salary as well, because he was criminally underpaid. I think it was close to between $30,000 and $40,000 per month, which is very, very poor.
Right on.
All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us in our Group D preview. Really appreciate everyone, Sasha, Amar, Jeremy, Murad. Thank you for walking us through these four teams. Group D is certainly going to be an interesting group and a lot of competitive matches. I think we think collectively that France and Denmark are the two to beat here, but perhaps there's a surprise in store for Group D. So we will see once we get to Qatar, and just want to thank everyone for listening as well. You can find us at Window INTL Pod, The Window, everything international related. You can find myself at @we_global, at We Global Football, international football statistics, odds, projections, all that good stuff, and find Joe on Twitter at 12th Yank as well for a lot of international content too. So I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today, and we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, and if, for those of you who haven't maybe had the opportunity to check out any of our other previews, so this is number 7 of 8. So this is our seventh group that we've done. So we've done 6 others. And if you want to hear what we discussed with some other great guests in our other shows, you're welcome to check that out as well. So yeah, thanks everybody. Thanks to our panel. I know it's late and where some of you are, it's probably after midnight. So we really appreciate you hanging with us. So yeah, thank you.
Early morning for Sasha as well.
And early morning, yeah. So thanks everybody. Really appreciate it.
Take care, guys. No problem.